On the program today, the business of oil, the business of politics, and some people trying to make it in business. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Rima Khreis, in for Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, August 12th. Good to have you along. The Biden administration yesterday did something that some considered peculiar, something that had some folks in the energy industry scratching their heads. The administration wrote a letter to OPEC and its allies, and they said, listen, gasoline prices are high. Can you all please boost your oil output? Texas Governor Greg Abbott had some thoughts about this. So as one does, he went to Twitter. He tweeted, Dear White House, Texas can do this. Our producers can easily produce that oil if your administration will just stay out of the way. But is it that simple? We asked Marketplace's Andy Euler to find out.
U.S. politicians pressuring OPEC? It's not a new thing. Antoine Hauf at Columbia University says President Clinton did it. President Trump did it.
There's a tradition of calling on OPEC and putting the blame on OPEC for high prices and asking very publicly OPEC to increase supply to bring the price down.
But squeezing OPEC rarely works. It's a powerful cartel. Doesn't have to lose too much sleep over rising gas prices in the U.S. Sarah Vakshery, president of the oil and gas consultancy SVB Energy, says American politicians also have limited control at home.
So the U.S. government have no say really on how much the oil production should be.
That is up to private energy firms, which means Texas Governor Greg Abbott can't just tell oil companies in the Permian Basin to start pumping to increase supply. Clark Williams Derry is an analyst at the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. He says at the moment, the U.S. oil industry is telling itself,
don't overproduce. Don't pretend like today's price blip is a great long-term opportunity. Exercise what they call capital discipline.
Which he says is shorthand for just drill less.
This is an industry that's been burned again and again by overproduction. They respond to high prices by ramping up drilling, and then they wind up producing too much oil and gas, and the prices come back down, and they don't make the money they're expecting to.
Something else unexpected? Environmentalists were surprised when the Biden administration encouraged OPEC to ramp up production because, says Charles Driscoll, an environmental engineering professor at Syracuse,
if we're interested in transitioning and decarbonizing the economy, having higher gas prices helps move us in that direction.
Because consumers paying, say, $5 a gallon for gas could motivate some to make the switch to an electric car. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, major indices didn't look so bad at close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A big headline from today is the trove of results from the 2020 census. Some long-awaited data, the first detailed stats breaking down where people in America live, along with info about their race, ethnicity, age, housing. Looking over the data, here are some of the big takeaways. America is more diverse and more multiracial than ever before. In fact, the total white population shrank for the first time in the nation's history. Meanwhile, more than half of all counties saw their population actually decline since 2010. So that means almost all of the population growth is happening in cities. There is obviously a lot more in there, but this data, I should say, can be incredibly, incredibly consequential. It'll set off what is going to be a huge political fight in many state houses across the country, the scramble to redraw congressional maps. And as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, of course, there is a lot of money involved.
District lines based on the new census data will shape politics for the next decade. But it's not like the kind of money going into, say, a presidential campaign. Sarah Sadwani teaches political science at Pomona College and serves on California's State Redistricting Commission.
Our commission probably has one of the most generous commission redistricting budgets across all 50 states. We have a budget of approximately $16 million.
Some states use commissions, like the one in California. Others draw lines in the state legislatures. And lots of people who have to be paid weigh in. Davia Downey teaches public administration at the University of Memphis.
We have political scientists, we have social scientists, we have mathematicians, we have statisticians, we have lawyers that are looking at the legality of different lines.
Then there's the spending from interest groups, many of which are flush with cash at the moment. Both national parties have their own redistricting committees and are getting ready for inevitable legal challenges to the new district maps. So are nonpartisan groups like the Campaign Legal Center.
We have been hiring more lawyers, and we have staff dedicated to this project to bring transparency to the process.
Mark Gaber is director of redistricting for the group.
To ensure that, you know, both nonpartisan interests are promoted, but also to ensure that, in particular, communities of color don't become the victim of this redistricting process.
Because, he says, there's a real line, no pun intended, between redistricting and policies that affect everyone's lives. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
If you're looking for even more economic news, well, I've got some good news for you. See what I did there? You can check out the Marketplace Morning Report. Dave and Brocaccio and the gang get up early to tell you what you need to know to start your day. We know that the pandemic has been brutal for a lot of businesses. And while it's tough to get the hard numbers, in a study out earlier this year, the Fed estimated there were 200,000 more closures during the pandemic than we'd usually see in a given year. Which leads me to Kiki Araneta in Philadelphia. Back in 2013, she and her partner started a new venture.
We left grad school the year prior and did the thing that everybody tells you not to do. We bought a food truck.
Inspired by Kiki's upbringing, they served Hawaii's local cuisine and called the food truck Poi Dog.
So Poi Dog means mixed breed or mutt. And in 2017, we opened a restaurant in Philadelphia's Rittenhouse neighborhood.
And things went well, like super well.
It was really, really busy. We catered a lot for the corporations around us, as well as for UPenn, which was our biggest customer.
UPenn, meaning University of Pennsylvania. But then, of course, the pandemic happened. And in July of 2020, Kiki and her partner decided to close Poi Dog for good. I asked her about that decision.
We had like a citywide shutdown. So basically all restaurants were forced to do delivery and takeout as like their only dining options. And we did that for a little bit, for like a few days. And the fees for delivery on the restaurant side are extremely steep.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We were signed up with Grubhub, Uber Eats, Caviar, DoorDash, like pretty much everybody. And the base rate for that was about 30%. So if you have like 30% labor, 30% delivery fee, 30% food, that leaves pretty much
you're
nothing.
You're not making a lot.
Exactly. Yeah. Like you're taking a loss with every single delivery order. So with weddings canceled, meetings are like all over Zoom and classes at UPenn and Drexel not in session, like we were just not making any money at all. So very end of July, we announced that we were closing because it just financially did not make any sense.
Mm. Emotionally, what was that like?
I feel like I blacked out for 2 weeks.
Yeah. And I mean, how'd you know so early on that that was the right move for you all?
I mean, I don't think I really did. Mm-hmm. We had inherited a restaurant that was closed very, very poorly. Mm-hmm. Like I cleaned like inches of black mold out of freezers, out of the walk-in. Mm. And I was determined that if I ever closed a restaurant, that would not be the case at all. Mm. So we scrubbed down the restaurant. We donated the majority of our equipment. I think, like, I feel like we made like a bunch of very small decisions that were good and decent. And like, I didn't know if the big decision of closing at that point was necessarily the right one, but yeah. It just felt like the only one because Like if a business isn't financially viable, then no matter like how wonderful and important it is, it just doesn't make sense to keep it open.
Yeah. Yeah. Ugh, it's just tough calculations to make. So you closed it back in July of 2020. So let's talk about today. What are you up to today?
So I've always had in the last few years, I had a pretty steady part-time gig of food writing, mm-hmm. and writing recipes for brands. So I got a lot of work on that side. Mm-hmm. And I did an event where I made chili pepper water, and okay. My friends at the event, they gave me a lot of advice about retail sauces, and they're like, hey, you should bottle this. And oh. I was like, you know what? That's a pretty good idea.
Oh, okay.
So that began like another sort of secondary career. I feel like all that's my amazing. Careers right now are secondary careers.
And it sounds like it was an accident, which is pretty amazing. You weren't like intentionally going out to make these sauces.
No, it was a total accident. I don't know what I was doing.
That's amazing. So where do you see yourself in the next few years? Do you want to make your way back into the restaurant industry?
I've been doing a lot of pop-ups, so I don't really miss cooking at this particular point. I don't have to worry about rent, and I don't have to worry about letting people into my own space. I definitely want to build up the sauces a bit more, mm-hmm. but I grew really big and fast. I also am... The first person who carried them is my best friend and soon-to-be bridesmaid, who happens to own a distribution company. So I definitely had a lot of help.
Amazing.
Like I fell into this, but mm-hmm. I had a lot of help.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I'm wishing you the best of luck, and I am looking forward to seeing what this next year brings you.
Thank you.
Kiki Araneta is the owner of Poi Dog Sauces in Philadelphia. Thanks so much, Kiki.
Thanks for taking the time.
Coming up,
a flower business for Mother's Day.
A boy with big ambitions. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones added 14 points, pretty much unchanged, to finish at 35,499. The NASDAQ is up 51 points, 0.3%, to end at 14,816. The S&P 500 rose 13 points, nearly 0.3%, to land at 4,460. As Andy Euler mentioned, the Biden administration has appealed to OPEC and its allies to boost oil production as one way to try to increase supply and bring down gas prices. So we cruise over to AAA to see where those prices have landed today. The current national average for regular gas is running about $3.81 a gallon. But here in California, that is more like $4.39. We heard about consumer prices for July yesterday, which is a gauge of inflation. They were more moderate than anticipated, but today we got the producer price index for last month. That measures prices at the wholesale level for goods before they reach consumers. And that jumped 1% higher than expected. Over the last 12 months, prices at the wholesale level are up a record 7.8%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.36%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Rima Khreis. We've been talking about infrastructure pretty much all week, but let's step away from that for a moment to talk about another kind of infrastructure, one that is undoubtedly inextricably linked to the economy. Public health infrastructure is what Dr. Lena Wen has devoted her career to improving. She's an emergency room physician, former health commissioner of Baltimore, and she's written a new memoir about the links between public health and really everything else. It's called Lifelines, A Doctor's Journey in the Fight for Public Health. Lena, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great to join you today.
The way you describe the concept of public health really stuck with me. Basically, you say that every day public health is saving our lives, but we just don't realize it. What do you mean by that?
By definition, public health is successful when we have prevented something from happening. Mm-hmm. And then by definition, there is no face of public health. I mean, there is the face of a child who was lead poisoned, but not the face of a child who could have been lead poisoned, except that his home had been remediated. And I think this is the reason, though, why public health becomes the first on the chopping block, because people don't understand it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were the health commissioner of Baltimore, and one thing that surprised me was just the broad scope of your job, how you described it in the book. You did everything from animal control to fighting the opioid epidemic. And it made me wonder if people really understand the role that local public health departments play in their lives and ultimately in the economy.
Oh, I definitely don't think that people understand the role of the health departments at all. I mean, I think there may be better understanding now because of COVID, as in I would wager that prior to COVID, people didn't even know that there was a state health department. There is often a city and county health department and the interplay between them. I bet people never really thought about that. And I think now people equate public health with infection control, which is, of course, an important component, but that's certainly not all we do. And so, for example, in Baltimore, yes, restaurant inspections fell under the health department. I also oversaw school health in every single one of our 180 public schools, as well as senior centers. I mean, that all is public health. Of course, the scope of public health depends on where you are in the country. But I think that coming out of COVID, not that we're done with COVID, but I think there is a real opportunity to let people know about how whatever issue they care about directly relates to public health. As in, if somebody cares about public safety or the economy or education, there is a direct link to the work of health departments, too.
It's all interconnected. Like, you write that public health is housing, it is food, it is clean air, it is education. And it's basically the ability to level an unequal playing field. And you know, you're a doctor, and there's this phrase that you borrow from medicine to describe the public health condition of the U.S., and that phrase is acute on chronic. What does that mean, and how does that apply to the situation we're in today?
Yeah, there are ongoing chronic issues, but then you overlay on top of that an acute exacerbation, if you will. This is what we often talk about in medicine, is in somebody may have diabetes, but then there's something that occurs and then they have an acute exacerbation. It suddenly is getting worse. And now they end up in the hospital with very high blood sugars because of that. Maybe I'm getting too clinical with my analogy here.
No, this is helpful for the non-doctors out there. Yeah.
But the idea is that in public health, this often happens. So one of the chapters of the book, for example, I talk about the uprisings that occurred after the death of Freddie Gray and how in the aftermath of the uprisings, there were so many people who had mental health concerns, who were experiencing acute trauma. But it wasn't new, as in there was already this undercurrent of unmet need when it came to mental health and trauma. Then you lay on top of that this acute exacerbation. Both have to be treated. We have to talk about systemic racism, inequities, disparities, how racism itself is a health issue. I mean, you got to get there. But there are short-term things that you can do right now. So, for example, at that time, we set up a 24/7 mental health and trauma hotline. We did healing circles with our schools. I mean, there were short-term actions that you can take while also longer-term addressing these issues that for a long time have been there, too.
Well, yeah, to your point, you mentioned in your book that back in 2015, you started calling out racism as a public health issue, and that raised a lot of eyebrows. You know, people understood racial disparities as a public health issue, but not necessarily structural racism. Do you think the pandemic has helped shift people's understanding?
I do. I definitely think that people understand the idea of health disparities. But again, sometimes when these issues are interrelated, I think there can be decision paralysis, as in, I think some people could say, hey, if everything's related to everything and the problems are longstanding, what can I do right now? And that's what I try to make a point of in Lifelines, of saying, yes, these problems are really hard, but there are things that you can do. There are tangible steps that you can do. I mean, for example, around the opioid epidemic, I got criticized, frankly, for why it is that we focused on naloxone initially, getting the opioid antidote to every resident in our city. Right. And people said, that's not a long-term solution. Why are you doing that? That's only helping somebody right now. Well, first of all, if somebody is dead today, there's no chance of a better tomorrow. But second of all, it was something tangible that we could do and show people that while we're working on long-term solutions, we can address this right now.
Lena Nguyen is an emergency room physician, former Baltimore Health Commissioner, and contributing columnist for The Washington Post, and she is the author of her memoir just out, Lifelines, A Doctor's Journey in the Fight for Public Health. Thanks so much for your time, Lena.
Thank you for having me join you today.
Parents, take a look at your kids right now. Behind those sweet, angelic eyes could lie the mind of a cutthroat business tycoon, just waiting, yearning to come out. And perhaps they're just waiting for the perfect moment to realize it. Which brings us to our next segment.
My name is Luca, and I'm 10. The business I started was a flower business for Mother's Day. It was supposed to be like cheap delivery flowers because I read online that good flowers cost up to $200 plus delivery taxes. So I was doing cheap flowers because a bunch of people, like husbands, didn't want to get super expensive flowers. I went to the flower mart and bought a bunch of flowers, and I got vases. I filled those up with water, put the flowers in, and they actually looked pretty good. Everyone texted me what they wanted to say. I got pieces of paper and typed up all the messages, then glued those to little sticks and then stuck those in too with the flowers. I made 23 arrangements. They all looked like unique and great in their own way. The way I got customers was I printed up pieces of paper and they all said that I'd be selling flowers and cookies. And then I delivered them all and put them in people's mailboxes. I had to walk everywhere, and it was so tiring. My legs had so many cramps the next day. It was $40 for half a dozen cookies and one vase of flowers. I made $300, but my dad said every dollar I gave to charity, he would double it. So since I gave $300 to charity, he gave me $600 in return, even though he hasn't yet. I think I'm going to use it for my next business, or maybe I'll spend it on an arcade machine, because my parents said they would never let me get one. So I wait till they're not on the scene.
Hoping you get that arcade machine, Luca. We're rooting for you. This story, by the way, comes from our Marketplace podcast, Million Bazillion, answering the questions kids have about money. You can catch seasons 1 and 2 wherever you get your podcasts. This final note on the way out, saw this in Bloomberg and needed to share it with y'all. So we've talked a lot on this program about the hot housing market and the soaring lumber prices. Well, the effects of that have trickled down to an unusual place. It is impacting cheese, like, you know, cheddar. Apparently, there's been a shortage of wooden boxes that hold 640-pound blocks of cheese, the kind that ends up shredded or as cubes on party platters. To make up for it, the industry has produced more 500-pound barrels of cheese, the kind that's good for process varieties like Kraft or Velveeta. So now, with all these new barrels in the market, we're seeing the lowest prices for processed cheese in more than a year, which you could say is a Gouda thing. Okay, that was cheesy. I'm done now. All right, we gotta go. But first, here's your moment of economic context for the day. According to the Labor Department, new applications for jobless benefits declined for the third straight week. They totaled to 375,000 last week, down from 387,000 in the prior week. Those numbers are still not quite where they were before the pandemic, but they're getting closer. And generally, the number of applications has been falling pretty steadily since they topped about 900,000 back in early January. Experts say the Delta variant could hurt this streak, but as of now, the labor market seems to still be chugging along. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Rima Khreis, and we'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.